So, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Richard Kitney. I'm from Imperial College London, as I think I was saying earlier. And I'm the moderator for this session on health and medicine, the final session for this afternoon. I'm not really going to say a lot by way of introduction to this session, except to say that I'd make 2 points. The first point I'd make is that there's been quite a lot of discussion this afternoon about the complexities of synthetic biology. And as somebody who works in this field, because I'm, as I was saying earlier, the co-director of the EPSERC Centre for Synthetic Biology at Imperial College, nobody ever told me that this was going to be easy. So I think that's something to bear in mind. And when you look at the development of things like transistors, you know, which took 50 or 60 years to get to the point where we're at now, you know, if you project that far out in terms of synthetic biology, I believe there are going to be some major applications, major industrial developments, etc. Why now is a question that I'm often asked, and for me the reason is because we've now reached a point in terms of, say, sequencing the human genome and sequencing in general, plus the power of computers, the internet, etc., where you have the kind of confluence of the two fields, biology on the one hand and engineering and physics on the other, which has made this new field of synthetic biology really possible. And I have spent quite a lot of my research life working on biomedical applications of various kinds. And so when I started to work in the area of synthetic biology, for me it was an extension, a really exciting extension, a lot of the work that I and my colleagues around the world had done in the past in terms of different applications, for example, in physiological applications, now beginning to apply the same kind of engineering theory, physics theory, you know, signal processing, systems theory, etc., to looking down at the areas related to synthetic biology. So it's particularly pleasant for me, actually, to be moderating this session on biomedical applications. As was said in the last session, it's really quite difficult to predict what are the applications, indeed, in this area. But, I mean, if we wanted to project out, I believe that it's pretty hard to set any kind of timescale, but I think we will see major advances in biosensors coming out of this field. I would also probably predict that we may see major advances in terms of vaccines, so-called third-generation vaccines, being influenced by synthetic biology, and indeed optimization of drug developments, which Adriano is going to talk about. So that really takes me, therefore, to brief introductions to the three speakers, all of whom I know well. So the first is Adriano Henny, who's sitting at the front here. Adriano has a PhD in medicine, so he's from the UK. He's worked for many years in research, and until very recently, I won't go through the whole biographical sketches of these people, he has until recently been a senior member of AstraZeneca in the UK and is now an independent consultant. The second of our speakers is Frank Notke, who is a very senior scientist at GeneArt in Germany. And certainly if you come from Europe, as I do, GeneArt is a really exciting and innovative company that we actually work directly with. So I think it's a great pleasure for me to have Frank here to present the industrial perspective from the point of view of GeneArt in terms of synthetic biology. And finally, we have Roman Girala, who is the head of the biotechnology department at the National Institute of Chemistry in Slovenia. I think one of the things that excites me about Roman's work is that he, like me, is one of the leaders of the iGEM teams, and that's really, I'm a leader with my colleague Paul Fremont, but iGEM has been an incredibly stimulating way of getting into synthetic biology, and you know, I would actually say that Randy Ratberg and Jurendi and the other people who are involved in, who's really started iGEM, really started something which has now turned into a major field. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Adriana to give the first of these presentations.
Thanks, Dick, and thanks very much to the organisers for inviting me to this very interesting meeting. Just to pick up on what Dick said about not saying it was very easy, it's quite interesting. It's now 40 years since man first put their foot on the moon, and I think it was 61 or 62 that President Kennedy actually said that they decided to put that programme together, not because it was going to be easy, but precisely because it was going to be very hard and it was going to stretch human endeavour and really test our ability to see where we could go. And I think that there are many analogies here which are being made about Man on the Moon project for synthetic biology. The same analogies have been made for systems biology, which is really where I come from. But there are huge parallels and overlaps, and I think it would be an injustice and perhaps a huge mistake to ignore these two parallel and sister communities. I think it's important for us to remember that. So the focus is health and medicine here. I'm going to give you a view from the pharmaceutical sector, specifically big companies, major issues, and that's where I'm going to come from. It's very difficult, actually, to talk about synthetic biology in that context, simply because, as far as I'm aware, major pharmaceutical companies are not indulging in synthetic biology to any great extent. So to look at where these things could have an impact, I've gone to the report that Dick chaired at the Royal Academy of Engineering, where there are 5, 10, and 25-year horizons that are reported. Now, taking from those the key elements that may have an impact on pharmaceutical industry and the innovative medicines. The first is around improving and reproducing natural therapies. Artemisinin is an example of that. The opportunities for scaling up and improving processes, which is going to have an impact on reducing the bottom line and therefore improving the margins that the companies have to face at the moment, is always going to be important. There's a lot of focus on now on processes and improving processes. Biosensors, very, very interesting point. I think as we go into looking at more exotic, more challenging, more difficult therapies in complex disease, one of the difficulties is that we don't really understand them terribly well, and we don't have much quantitative dynamic data, and the ability to collect that quantitative dynamic data non-invasively or in minimally invasively ways is a challenge, and I suspect that synthetic biology may have a part to play there. Optimization of biopharmaceutical production, that is therapeutic antibodies and the like, obviously is something that's already been mentioned. And really the big one is around personalized therapy. I don't particularly like that word, but it's used a lot. I prefer to think in terms of patient segmentation, that is to be able to identify effectively those groups which have a far better chance of responding to your complex therapies compared with those who are less likely to do so, and an ability to use markers and approaches which confidently can segment your patient groups will be an important advance in the way that we go forward with pharmaceuticals in general, and it will also help us to reduce the concomitant toxicity that's presented with all of these therapies to patients. But I mean, that's a list of push. If you want to think about it, we as academics, we as scientists can see quite logically where this is going to go and why industry should be interested in. And, you know, you're actually pushing it towards industry. Actually, the truth of the matter is you've got to have a suck. You've got to have industry there which is wanting to take this on board if they're going to receive it. So the way I want to look at this is actually to look at the demand that could potentially be there, where that's going to come from in the near future. And perhaps that will help to shape and to put into context the kind of proposals that the synthetic and the systems biology communities can put to industry more persuasively in order to work together, which I think is an important point. Starting with the valedictory article by Jean-Pierre Garnier, as he left GlaxoSmithKline, he pointed out, and you can see it in the little red box there, that from December 2000 to February 2008, the top 15 companies in the industry lost approximately $850 billion in terms of shareholder value, and the price of their shares fell from 32 times their earnings to an average of 13, and that's quite an impact. That wasn't really big news, because there were other articles that were predicting 4 or 5 years earlier that this was going to be the case. This is one such in Nature Biotechnology by Lee Hood and Roger Perlmutter, where they presciently suggested that $80 billion of revenue would be lost by 2008. But more importantly, I think that they actually focused on the point that the current processes and approaches to generating pharmaceuticals was not going to be sustainable for the future. It needed to change in some kind of way, and they were proposing systems approaches in this paper. So why is this? And I think, well, if you look at the way we've built up the pharmaceutical industry, it's become incredibly reductionist. Post-genome, everything's focused on single entities. Everything's focused on isolated proteins, cell lines, engineered cell lines, exquisitely tailored chemicals, taken completely out of physiological context, and then trying to translate that data back to humans by increasingly using associative models, which may or may not have any relationship to the pure human physiology at the end. So you're making tenuous connections using screens, building up from a very, very reductionist space. And I think the consequence of that, of course, is you can't predict, you know, how your compound is going to respond in an aged individual who's already taking 5 or 6 other drugs and has comorbidities beyond the one that you're trying to treat. This is a dynamic, complex series of network interactions where the networks in pathology have shifted from normal into pathology, and you need to treat a network to drag it back to normality. And that is impossible to understand on an isolated protein and chemical basis. So we need then to move from where we are now to have a step change in science, where we move from this sort of guess and pray mentality that we've been having with these screens and hoping that we're going to hit pay dirt by running many, many more compounds through and playing the numbers game, to one where we adopt a predict and test strategy. And in that sense, modeling and simulation is key to being able to generate hypotheses which are testable and which then help you to focus your way forward. And this is the systems biology approach that I'm talking about. And if we look, the comment was made earlier that it was that we started as an observational science. Actually, physiology started very much as an organ function and metabolism science that was descriptive and identifying cellular components. With the advent of molecular biology, we became reductionist, being able to focus on those things where they were missing in the descriptions in the early physiology. Now we've come full circle. We've got a stack of data, huge amount of data and information, but we can't put it together in the networks and understand how they interact to generate the emergent properties of the physiological points that you're looking at. And for me, systems biology is the basis for generating 21st century modern physiology with a toolbox that they would have loved to have had back in the 19th century and earlier. So if we look at synthetic biology then, in terms of drug discovery and development, I think that what we've seen so far is that the current success is in the area essentially of metabolic engineering around artemisinin. Greatly lauded, fantastic success story. But it is in a particular side of therapeutics, which, if you look at it compared with the sorts of drugs that we're trying to develop for cancer or cardiovascular disease or metabolism or whatever, is much, much more straightforward in development terms than it is to target metabolic dysfunction or cancer networks in humans, because essentially you're trying to kill off the invading organism. So if you're extending to complex target physiology, human physiology as targets, compared with an invading organism or microbiological, then you need to have an understanding of how that system is going to respond to the therapy and the way that it's operating to generate the pathology in the first place. So we need to understand those interventions if we're able then to design those drugs appropriately, because you still have the same problems that we have with current therapies. So synthetic biology will face that as soon as it starts thinking cancer, as soon as it starts thinking infection. So synthetic and systems biology are very tightly linked in the context of human biology and medicine. The hurdles and challenges that we have in industry are building evidence of potential utility. We've got to be able to have credible, reproducible evidence. We've got to be able to talk the same language. That's the cartoon up there. There is a natural resistance and a skepticism in industry, simply because we had our fingers burnt post-genome with huge promises and under-delivery. And the skills point that was made earlier today, absolutely, in terms of industry, we need to have these skills in place. Key developments in synthetic and systems biology will largely be driven out of academia. We absolutely have to find ways of bringing academia and industry together, but at the same time be able to demonstrate applicability of the academic learning in an industrial and commercially relevant context. That, I think, is where the drive will come. That's where the suck will come. That's what happened with the genome. You needed new DNA machines. You needed technology development. As soon as you've got the suck there, then the innovation and inventiveness will come on around the outside. We have significant economic and regulatory constraints in industry right now. The question is, how do we actually work this at a time when the appetite for doing blue sky stuff with industry is going to be reduced simply because it's not delivering quickly to the bottom line? There are opportunities there. There are mechanisms, as I've mentioned. As far as going back to Lee Hood and Perlmutter's paper was concerned, they actually put this forward at the time in 2004 and asked the question, who will lead the extraordinary change process, the step change in science, the sea change in thinking and approach to where we go? And unfortunately, the jury is still out on that. We picked this up last year at a workshop when we published a commentary in Nature in October, which suggested some ways of actually bringing the different communities and stakeholders together to actually drive this forwards from a systems biology perspective, but it's equally relevant in synthetic biology, perhaps even more so because you've got a tangible deliverable, whereas systems biology is more about doing things in a different way. And I picked this up also quite recently in a EMBO reports on a science society topic, which is basically, again, asking who is going to take up the gauntlet to make this happen in a coordinated, focused way. Concluding points. There is no alternative to adopting systems approaches if we're going to face and tackle complex disease. We have to gather the right kind of evidence. We've got to show success, and it's imperative to demonstrate impact. And this is relevant both for synthetic and systems biology. There is a lot of effort going on. I suspect there's quite a lot of funding. There certainly is for systems biology. Perhaps it's so the case with synthetic biology, but the question is better coordination to generate impact. Are we ignoring potential benefit to the human simply because we're failing to find the mechanisms to get industry on board and demonstrate that impact? And finally, in my concluding, perhaps slightly tongue-in-cheek, is suggesting that we get rid of all of these terms. I think, you know, we're doing ourselves no favor. Somebody said this earlier today. My suggestion would be that perhaps systems biology is nothing more than 21st century physiology, and synthetic biology is nothing more than modern bioengineering. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Adriano. So our next speaker is Frank Knopfler, who's from GeoArt.
There you go.
Okay, thank you. So, good afternoon, everybody. Today I'm going to talk about the opportunities that gene synthesis offers for synthetic biology, and I'm actually focusing on one example from the biomedical sector, and so this will be probably the only more technical presentation. And the title is Vaccine Development in the Context of Synthetic Biology Principles. And the principle I'm referring to is this construction cycle that can also be seen as a process workflow for the development of novel systems that is also used for synthetic biology. So this cycle is actually based on knowledge, and from this knowledge, we have different steps regarding specification design circuits. Is this on?
The slides have gone off for some reason.
Okay. Specifications, the design, the modeling, implementation, and at the final step also the testing. Now, what I want to show you is that this construction cycle can also be applied for modern vaccine development. So the objective of this project that we realized during the last years was to develop an HIV vaccine based on HIV genes that would be possible to use as a genetic vaccine. That is, the requirement for this objective was that the genes that we included in our vectors really had to express very nicely. And that was actually the first challenge because HIV genes are not very well expressed in human cells if they are isolated from the viral background. I will skip all these technical details. The main message is that this failure of expression could be attributed to cis-acting repressor sequence within the whole genome that promoted a rapid degradation of the RNA. And only if you apply or if you supply some viral and cellular factors, this rapid degradation can be rescued. Now, the point is that once we exchanged the codons that were used by the HIV with codons used more frequently in human genes, we could circumvent this whole process, this whole regulation, and we really got nice expression of our antigen. So coming to the specifications, this was of course also a challenge because up to now we are working on HIV vaccine development for more than 15 years and there is no really success story up to date. So in this process we used an integrated vaccine strategy where we looked at different aspects. The first one was really to identify the prevalent virus strain in the area where we wanted to test and also later apply this vaccine. And at the same time, we were asking what kind of immune response do we actually want to induce. And in that time, it was actually acknowledged that for an effective HIV vaccine, you need really to induce a broad immune response. Now, from these different aspects, we were able to define the targets that we would like to include in our vaccine as listed here. And in the second step, we had also to decide which delivery system we would use. And from the many options, including proteins or peptides, DNA, viral or bacterial vectors, we have chosen naked DNA and viral vectors for the development. Now with these specifications at hand, we did a rational antigen design with a strong focus on function, safety, and efficacy. So starting from the isolate, the C virus that we identified as the prevalent strain, we wanted to include as much as possible from the genetic sequence in order to include as many as possible functions that is immunological relevant epitopes in our antigen. For safety reasons, part of the proteins were split and sometimes scrambled, and the active sites were removed from this whole construct, and some additional modifications were introduced to enhance the efficacy of the production and also of the secretion of this antigen. So in analogy to conventional modeling, we do also some modeling for, let's say, expression characteristics. So we developed an algorithm that usually optimized a given gene for a specific host. And in this optimization process, we take different parameter into account, like adaptation of the codon usage or GC content. We avoid negative elements like sequence repeat, RNA, secondary structures, or functionally motifs like splice sites. And then in sliding window approach, all these different parameters were optimized in parallel in overlapping windows that were sequentially moved forward. The application in our case is a two-step process where we use gene synthesis, of course, and in a second step, the vector production. And in contrast to what Kurt Taylor had presented in the previous session, we do a rather old-fashioned gene synthesis at GeneArt. This is also a multidisciplinary process where we have an IT-based design, we have chemically synthesized oligonucleotides, and we have genetic engineering for gene synthesis and assembly. From the different delivery systems that that we have categorized in actually two categories, that is DNA, plain plasmid DNA, or vaccinia-derived viral vectors, we have chosen the DNA and the New York Vaccinia Ankara virus system to proceed to the clinical trial. And for the development of a vaccine, the ultimate test is, of course, a clinical study. And here, short overview of the result of the phase one clinical study, where we compared two immunization regimes. Part of the volunteers received vaccinia virus only. This is represented in the white bars. And the other 20 volunteers received the prime boost regimen, where we used our synthetic DNA expression construct and the vaccinia virus. So overall, we got a very good response. And as you can see here from the different bars, the prime boost was superior to the vaccinia alone regimen, and not only in the overall number of responders, but also in terms of durability, which can be seen as success in inducing memory immune cells. So actually what I have shown is that the vaccine, our candidate vaccine, was developed along this construction cycle. And so someone might argue that what I have just shown you is preliminary DNA genetic protein engineering, whatever. But since we are talking about opportunities and innovation, I think that gene optimization and gene synthesis can greatly attribute to at least the highlighted steps of the cycle. For example, if you look at design, then the gene optimization provides very much to standardization just by making use of the high flexibility that is provided by codon choice and by sequence modification. And we did a comparative study where we analyzed 50 genes for expression in human cells. We compared wild-type and optimized sequences. And from this result, we got a couple of implications. One is that optimization and gene synthesis is really reliable. That is to say that not all of the wild-type genes were expressed in cells, whereas all of the tested optimized genes, for all of these genes, we could detect protein in the cells. The second implication is just availability. So it was just not possible to get all the wild-type sequences from commercial or other sources other than gene synthesis. And the last one is efficacy. So in this comparative study, we have seen that the majority of genes performed much better in the optimized version versus the wild-type version. And so I can stop here. Thank you.
You're running? Yep. Can you put mine here? Okay. Thank you very much, particularly for the organizers for inviting me to present our results and my view on the role of synthetic biology in medicine. What I would like to show that basically I think that there are four different types of application of synthetic biology in medicine, namely as an alternative means of drug production, as we have heard today several times, artemisinin, then biosensors, and then engineering of human cells, which would be more applied in a form of gene therapy, and then new therapies that haven't been used before. So in my presentation, I will, at the end of the day, show you two examples of our applications. The first one is in the area of engineering the synthetic signaling pathway. Particularly, that will be an example to the device, a mutation-insensitive device to detect viruses and trigger antiviral activity. And then the second example, to use the designed vaccines. We heard today about the potentials of vaccines in synthetic biology. And in our example, I will show you how we were made the components of bacteria that otherwise evade immune system, again visible to mount the immune response. So I'm sure you're all aware with the problem of HIV and AIDS, and the life cycle of virus has been extensively studied, and inhibitors of lots of the stages in viral replication have been designed. But the main problem is the high rate of mutation. As Victor said before, there's a Darwinian evolution, but in the case of HIV virus, it works against us. So almost every fifth individual in USA carries the strain of virus that is resistant to one or another type of drugs. That's why we have to use the combination therapy, which makes the virus difficult to become resistant against several other ways. So we thought about the idea of using the principles of synthetic biology, how to devise a system that would avoid this problem of mutations. And we came to the conclusion that the only way would be to couple the response to the viral function rather than a specific viral protein. Virus can develop a mutation resistance against drugs that target certain proteins, but they need certain functions. And we have tested this principle in two cases in the two viral functions. One is cell attachment, and the second is specific viral protease. And what's important about this principle is that's the general principle that can be applied also against other viruses that have a certain specific function that we can attached to. And the second important feature is that this type of response is versatile. So we can, as you will see later in schematic representation, we can attach to it any type of desired antiviral defense. So the first function that I mentioned is the very early step in the viral replication, the attachment of virus to cells. It binds to the two cellular receptors, CD4 and CCR5, and forms a heterodimer. And that's exactly the step which we could detect, namely the formation of heterodimer. And formation of heterodimer could be detected by reconstitution of split proteins. You can take a protein with a defined fold and cut it into the two segments, and then only when the binding partners to those segments associate, then you get the reconstitution of this function. And it's even better if that split protein is an enzyme, because you get an amplification of the function. So you do not detect only one signal from one virus, but an amplified signal. So the principle of the principal idea is as following. So we have engineered the two cellular receptors by the addition of two segments of the specific protease, and when the virus binds to the cell, it triggers formation of a heterodimer. The protease that's attached to those partners reconstitutes, and this protease can then cleave the transcription factor that's anchored to the cell membrane. So in this case, we can select any type of orthogonal transcription factor that does not activate any of the normal eukaryotic cell proteins. In our case, we selected the T7 RNA polymerase, which is well known, particularly for the work in bacteria, but does not transcribe any of the proteins in human genome. So when the protease is activated, the transcription factor translocates into the nucleus, and then it can select any type of program, be it either the caspase to kill the infected cells to prevent further spread of infection, or to produce interferon alpha to prime other neighboring cells against the virus, or to activate ApoBec or any other similar type of function. And we have also, of course, shown that the principle, the proof of the principle. So in this case, we couple the gene fluorescent, green fluorescent protein as a reporter, and you can see in the normal cells which harbor this antiviral device, you get no activation, but in the cells which have been exposed to the viral GP120 or pseudovirus, you get the activation, showing that the system indeed detects binding of the virus. And the second viral function is the specific HIV-specific protease, which cleaves a certain specific sequence, and we can use basically very, very similar approach, with the only difference that the linker that anchors the transcription factor to the membrane contains the specific site for HIV protease, which is cleaved, and then again the antiviral program is activated, which is have been also shown to work in transfected cells, so that those are the cells without of the protease and cells which have the HIV specific protease. So the second part that I want to describe you is the vaccines. So Helicobacter pylori is a gram-negative bacteria that colonizes human stomach and duodenum. So in the audience, I guess probably I could estimate probably 50 people harbor this bacteria, and probably in 20% of the people have some symptoms like the gastritis or ulcer, and in a small but nevertheless important fraction of people develop gastric cancer, which is one of the most lethal types of cancer. This infection can be treated, but probably the effective vaccine would be the best treatment, perhaps even to eradicate the bacteria. But the problem is how to develop a good vaccine. The bacteria has coexisted with humans for more than 100,000 years, and it adapted to humans by avoiding the recognition by the immune system through several different mechanisms. And one of the mechanisms is that this is flagellated bacteria containing flagelli, which are composed of the protein flagellin, also in E. coli or Salmonella, they have the flagella. But difference is that the flagellin from E. coli or Salmonella activates the innate immune system through binding to the toll-like receptor 5, which then activates the innate immune response, leading to the maturation of the adaptive immune system as well, but not the flagellin from Helicobacter pylori. Our approach was to engineer the flagellin by making the chimeric version of flagellin. We know that the N-terminal and C-terminal segment of flagellin from E. coli is responsible for binding and activation of TLR5, and that's the central segment is mostly important for the activation of adaptive immune system. So the solution was to make the chimeric protein composed of the segment from E. coli and the segment from Helicobacter pylori, which is now able to activate the innate immune system, but also has the antigens for the adaptive immune system. And we have additionally improved this vaccine by adding some other antigens, like the important virulence factor urea SB or in another application several composed artificial epitopes from several important virulence factors. So that's the sort of to use the modular principle of synthetic biology to devise perhaps could say a high-tech vaccine. And we have tested three different implementations of this vaccine, either as a normal, the protein vaccine, DNA vaccine, or as an engineered bacteria, which might be used perhaps for the oral application. So in the case of protein vaccine, we have isolated protein, shown that it does, so the chimeric protein does activate the TLR5, similar as the flagellin from Salmonella. And in the case of DNA vaccine, we have used similar approaches shown in the previous presentation. So in this case, we introduce the DNA into the epithelial cells, which then produce the flagellin, which then activates the antigen-presenting cells, which lead to the maturation of the immune system and response. Again, we have shown that the principle works in cells, but we have done also the first studies in mice. We have shown nice strong response after 3 weeks. And also that the synthetic vaccine indeed recognizes the life, the living bacteria. So to summarize, I think the combination of our understanding of the basic principles of immunology that has really tremendously advanced in the last decade, and the powerful tools of synthetic biology really opens very exciting therapeutic potentials. I have shown two examples. So one is the antiviral genetic device based on the viral function that avoids mutations, and the second, the designed vaccines that the same principle can again be used against other bacteria or perhaps even against cancer and other diseases. But of course, the synthetic biology in medicine has many other potential applications, like the development of engineering of defined cell types. Christina showed a very nice example, then targeting and so on. And at the end, let me just mention, of course, have to acknowledge the people who did experimental work. So all those results have been made as a by the undergraduate student teams that participated at IGEM competition, and Randy will speak more about it tomorrow. I just have to say that that's really an excellent way to introduce young people into the synthetic biology, but also beyond that, I think it's really a sort of an excellent testing ground to try really some very new radical ideas. And I would like to thank you for your attention.
Okay, so three very interesting talks. I wonder if we can open the discussion now. So starting off on the left over here, could you identify yourself, please?
Piers Millett with the Biological Weapons Convention Implementation Support Unit. Absolutely nothing to do with weapons. Given the potential of exactly the sort of things you're talking about to have real medical benefits, and I notice these are also diseases that perhaps disproportionately affect the developing world, which is also highly important. How do you think we can create frameworks where developing countries directly benefit in developing synthetic biology? So do you think it's possible? How can we bring partners in from developing countries to create a greater sense of ownership around the world?
Well, is this working? Okay. There are such partnerships already in place. I mean, there are non-for-profit organizations such as the Medicines for Malaria Venture. One World Health, I think, is the other one. And there are various ones which are joint ventures that bring academics and industrial partners together to create that. I was actually just reading the annual report from the Malaria's for Medicine Venture did yesterday. So they do exist for the benefit of the third world, and I think that that's quite a neat way of looking at it. If you think about the imperatives for large pharmaceutical companies, the opportunity to exemplify new approaches in areas where as far as they're concerned, it's not necessarily something that would be high on their agenda because of the return on the investment that will be necessary to be successful, then I think that's quite a pragmatic way of road testing ways forward. And I think increasingly there may be opportunities to think about that and at the same time benefit areas which are underserved in that way.
Roman, do you want to comment? And then
I mean, just that there's also another aspect. I think that there are also some potentials to develop some vaccines that might really be quite cheap. I mean, for example, modify the bacteria that could perhaps, I'm not saying that it works as of now, but perhaps to bacteria, the vaccines that are stable, that can be transported and that can be perhaps used orally. I think that's also quite important.
Frank?
I just would like to add, there is a lot of sponsoring opportunities in the EC, so especially the 6th and the 7th framework. They had a lot of projects that are really related to poverty-related diseases, and there's also a lot of international and trans-Europe, Africa, for example, processes going on.
Okay, let's take our next question over here.
Thank you, Gilfin McCombe, MIT. I once interviewed the CEO of a large pharmaceutical company who commented on the intelligent drug design experience, the last attempt at sort of doing this better, that he had wasted more than $1 billion and he would have been better off putting all the money in cash and putting it in a pile and lighting it on fire, because at least that would have been entertaining in terms of the results that he got from drug development, which was his first reason for really objecting to sort of new attempts at this. But the second and the more, I thought, more striking one, apart from the I've been burned reaction, was that he felt that many of these approaches were more likely to target much smaller populations of patients than the big pharmaceutical companies have made their bread and butter on. And that he felt, and I thought this seemed reasonable, that to target populations of that size would require significant, maybe even wholesale revisions in the regulatory structure surrounding pharmaceutical introduction. That running clinical trials powered to deal with this small numbers of the expenses involved and the potential profitability would be, his phrase was, nightmarish. And I wonder if you want to comment a little bit about the potential regulatory changes that we need to think about in terms of how we allow the drug, how we structure drug approvals, how we pay for clinical trials that would allow us to take advantage of the new techniques that you're talking about.
I have a similar question to that.
Yeah.
I have a follow-up question to that, very close
let's
to that.
Let's take the answers first, then you can.
Maybe they could answer both.
Please.
Okay.
Okay. It's a great question. I think that that there are two aspects. Well, firstly, let me just put my cards on the table. I wasn't involved in development at all. I was at the early end of drug discovery, so my experience in development is limited. But certainly the FDA, through their Critical Path Initiative, is looking very, very hard at different ways of changing the paradigm of drug discovery to address some of those things. Undoubtedly, the point about small patient groups and being powered statistically to be able to get a result is an important one. But I think that what we're looking at here is why I was thinking less of personalization but more of segmentation. You know, if you look at a study on arthritis with normal therapy, if you can produce a series of biomarkers that can improve your prediction of response from 40% to 60 or 70%, then in terms of the efficacy in the target population, it's increased significantly. The return on your investment's that much better. You can negotiate, or at least the authorities will negotiate different pricing structures based on success of the therapeutic, because they know that you can actually segment the population. There is evidence that that's already happened with one company voluntarily doing that in the United Kingdom. And I think that, you know, I don't know when that interview took place, but it's certainly a view that has to change. I mean, the technologies that we have are increasingly going towards segmentation for all of the benefits that I mentioned. And to stick your head in the sand and say that's not going to happen, I think is going to be a mistake.
You're probably referring to HIV, I guess, or what type of disease was that vaccine? Because there are lots of examples where where high-tech vaccines have been quite useful. For example, influenza, I think the synthetic biology now really allows us to literally in weeks or months you can have a new effective vaccine available.
Do you want to come back quickly?
I wasn't thinking about vaccines, which I know almost nothing about. But the problem with the arthritis, the hypothetical arthritis example that you're talking about, right, is right now, without the biomarkers, that drug will probably still score as efficacy, and I can sell it to 100% of arthritis sufferers. If I can only sell it to 40%, yeah, the efficacy is better, my cost to develop might be lower, but I've also cut my potential market by more than half, and it seems to me the economics, again, cut against...
I think it's an interesting point, but the issue is that you will, within all of that population that you're targeting, you will still only get a small percentage that will respond. Those that don't respond probably will have side effects which are not particularly pleasant, and those are consequences that you need to take into account. So the ethics of it is that if you know that you can segment and you can reduce the suffering to people who aren't going to respond, can you continue? And the answer to that is no. The corollary is also that if you're able to segment and you know what those markers are and you're able to market alongside it the diagnostic, then you've actually got a completely different investment stream and revenue stream, rather. So I think that those are things that need to be thought of in the context of development going forward.
Sorry, question over here. Then.
Can I just add?
Yeah,
Can I just add one thing, though? The COX inhibitors are exactly what you're talking about. If they had segmented the population, they wouldn't have run into the problem. So I just have to say that. Sorry.
Okay. Over here.
Now we talked about the market side of it. The regulatory side of it has a different problem with personalized medicine. Now, regulators across the world are moving on to a life cycle approach rather than a snapshot approach. Now, with a personalized targeted medicine, how do you evaluate a post-market surveillance system? Right now, the post-market surveillance depends on the signals that we receive and analysis of these signals, which are almost always statistical. Now, if you are targeting one individual or a very limited population, how are we going to regulate this medicine post-market?
Very quick answer. I can't answer that because I don't have any experience in that area.
It's
a problem.
The personalized medicine approach.
Well, it depends on the size.
As a regulator, I don't know.
Yeah, but it depends on the size of the population.
How will I gather pharmacovigilance?
I wish I could help you. I honestly don't know. I'm not got any experience in that area, so I can't offer any insight. It's a good question. I think it's one that needs to be tabled.
Should I be approaching every medicine individually and then withdraw it from the market every time?
All I can do is repeat. I can't answer that, your question.
The industry have a thinking about it?
I repeat again, I was not involved in development and I was not involved in regulatory processes, so I can't answer your question. I have absolutely no idea, but I'm sure it's being looked at.
Do either of the other speakers want to comment? No. Okay. Do you have another?
No.
Okay. While other people are thinking, can I just say, Adriano, that I was at a meeting at the Wellcome Trust 2 weeks ago, where actually a major American pharmaceutical company presented. I won't name them, and they were saying that unless systems biology. I know we're primarily talking about systems and synthetic, but I mean they are really, in my opinion, two sides of the same coin. These techniques in relation to systems biology, and I think you were saying also synthetic biology. Really brought in a major way into the pharmaceutical industry, their view was that certainly their company might implode. Would you like to comment on that?
I had a telephone conversation with an extremely senior European pharmaceutical executive 2 weeks ago where the comment that was made was that he is deeply, deeply concerned about the state of the pharmaceutical industry. In its current processes, and I think that there is no doubt that we do have to have that paradigm shift, that step change of where we go. Turning the handle faster and playing the numbers game isn't going to solve the solution because we still don't address the physiology. Will pharmaceutical companies implode? Who knows? They're not actually learning the lesson that was put at the door of the computer industry in the 70s and 80s, the challenges of new technologies, the way that the IBM and people just ignored that and eventually came in late. The music industry with Napster and all the rest of it have had to change their business models. GM producing cars and Chrysler producing cars that are not really the sorts of cars that we want. I think you have to be able to change. And I think that, unfortunately, the pharmaceutical industry is late to change. There are opportunities, I think, with the Innovative Medicines Initiative in Europe. If that comes together properly and that comes together looking at true innovation, then I think there is an opportunity to provide the evidence that's necessary to persuade industry to adopt these changes. But it has to be reduced to practice, to coin an engineering term, and sufficiently robust and consistent for it to be part of a regulated process for the production of medicines for humans.
Okay. Question over here.
Thank you. In the two previous sessions, there's been... I'm Benedict Callan. I'm with the OECD. In the two previous sessions, the speakers have identified some of the needs either for their industry or for research, and they've mentioned the development of registries, libraries, the standardization of parts as being something that's important in order for researchers and probably industry also to have access to the components that it is going to make synthetic biology as powerful as people hope it's going to be. None of you have mentioned that. Is there a reason for that? Are components and parts something that are important also in pharma and medicine? And I guess I'm having another thought, which is why I'm sort of at the same time trailing off. But one of the reasons that we've been interested in this issue at the OECD is, in fact, that we're very much interested in the whole set of issues around access to data, information, knowledge sharing. And one of the areas in which we have seen an evolution and some new thinking in the pharma sector has been in compound libraries and access to compound libraries. And there has been some slow but certain movement towards more sharing of access to compound libraries. So one of the areas that we've been thinking about is there a parallel between that and the way that one might create and share and access registries or libraries or whatever it is that's coming up in synthetic biology? And so if anybody has some comments on whether or not those are parallel situations and whether or not in the pharma sector libraries and registries of synthetic biology parts is important, I'd be interested to hear that.
Well, maybe I could just say first that the reason why we talk about parts, devices, and systems all being standard simply comes out of the engineering approach to how you design and develop devices and systems. I mean, that's the way it's done in engineering. Now, that may or may not be right in terms of synthetic biology, but that's how it's done in engineering. I mean, if you look at any jumbo jet or any car or any of those devices that we use in our everyday lives, the common approach to all of those devices and systems is, in terms of engineering, is to take, produce standard systems from standard devices, from standard parts. And that's really the basis of, this approach, if you like, to synthetic biology. It may not be correct, but it's the approach. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak for synthetic biology, but I can certainly talk about precisely this, because it was one of the topics that came out of the workshop that we had, the commentary for which was in Nature last October. I mean, the consensus was undoubtedly that there needed to be some sort of standardization. For example, of the modeling approaches. I mean, I think that that is necessary if it's going to be reduced to practice and be robust. There needs to be standardization in terms of the languages of the computer systems that are being used for modeling and simulation, and the databases that need to be put together. And there needs to be consistency so that you know that what you're looking at in lab A is the same as what it is in lab B. Similarly, it's going to be for assays. And there was a huge furore about assays and things like that, simply because people say, well, why do you need to standardize that? Why should we register our assay? Well, actually, if you go into any biochemical laboratory in a hospital, All of the enzyme assays are standardized. They're tested and they're subjected to routine robustness testing all the time. So I think that if you're going into regulated environments, if you're going to be operating that kind of system, then it's unavoidable that you have to have some form of standardization and a process of verification and checking. It applies to systems and synthetic biology, and that's why I say that there are, from technologies and the tools, there are huge overlaps that we must come together as a communities to actually put that in place.
Okay. Okay. Do either of you want to comment? No. Okay, well, that very nicely takes us up to 5:15, which is the time scheduled for the end of the session. So there are two things. Don't leave for a moment because I've got an announcement to make. But first of all, I just wanted to thank all the speakers for a very interesting session. The sort of housekeeping announcement is that there's an error on the program. There is now a reception immediately after this session, but the reception is actually on the third floor atrium, not the second floor atrium. And the organisers of the meeting have asked me to say if you could possibly walk up the stairs, that would be useful. So hopefully I'll see everyone up on the third floor atrium, not the second floor. Thank you. I'll stand up.